Sangha is invited to go back to our breathing so that our collective energy of mindfulness can bring us together as an organism, flowing as a river with no more separation. Let the whole Sangha breathe as one body, generate peace as one body, be free as one body. Let us transcend the boundaries of the delusive self, liberating from the superiority complex, the inferiority complex, and the equality complex.
So this is our first day of our four-day retreat here on January 2/11 at the Franciscan Center. Keep looking. The Buddhas or the Buddhist meditation practices on investigation. Keep looking. I think this is a wonderful verse that we do before the talk. It really it tells us what we are about individually and collectively. Our collective energy of mindfulness will bring us together. An organism going as a river with no more separation. The whole song to breathe as one body, generate peace as one body, be free as one body. Let us transcend the boundaries of the delusive self, liberating from the superiority complex, the inferiority complex, and the equality complex. I think that gives us our direction for retreat. And the practices that we will be doing, the teachings we will be looking at over these next 4 days, I think will help us to break down those boundaries and to liberate ourselves from the various complexes that the self imposes on our natural freedom. From our natural interconnection and oneness. And when we enter that place of going as a river implies what? We could say a river is the product of what? Many drops. Many individual drops come together and manifest as a river. A river is more than just its individual drops. It has a power. Even though it's in its essential nature, it is made up of these individual drops, which of course if we look deeply at them, we would find they really have no individuality. But just for the sake of talking, we would say that they're made up of individual drops, and yet as a river, a river is a wonderful thing. You wouldn't want to canoe or kayak in a drop of water. But we would like to raft on the river. Left to our own devices, our individuality, our individual efforts, we often find life difficult. But when we enter into the river of the larger organism, in this case, the Sangha, but the Sangha, as it's said in the verse, is found everywhere. There is no quarter of the universe where Sangha, community, connection, is not found, especially when there is no sense of separation. no complexes. We do want to be liberated from our complexes. Complex is an interesting word, now that I look at it right. Complexity. Self makes life complex. The practice of deep looking can liberate us from complexity and allow us to return to the basic simplicity of life. Some housekeeping things, but why don't we do those at the end of the talk? I did get a note from B. If I answered all your questions thoroughly, we would have to have a 10-day retreat. But they're all good questions. The first one in terms of Bodhidharma's teaching, because this is not a retreat on Bodhidharma, I won't go into it, but we will be teaching from Hakuin, a great Zen master who teaches in that style. So I think you'll get a sense of the Zen, the debate between Hoshang and Kama Lashila. He was considered to be a Zen teacher, Hoshang. But please understand that the version that is maintained in the Tibetan tradition is the version of the those who think they won the debate. There are other versions who won the debate. There are other versions which give a very different sense of what the debate was about and who won, actually, which is interesting. We know, if you're a historian, the history of the victors is different than the history of the so-called losers, right? The history of one country is often different than the history of another country looking at the same event, depending on their viewpoint. But that's a wonderful thing. But I liked your question, how does one meditate on that which one has not understood? I think that's a very wonderful question. And in Vipassana meditation, insight meditation, when we look mindfully and deeply, what are we trying to see? Those are good questions. Now, the questions about emptiness and Zen, we will deal with. So just a lot of these questions you have will be dealt with over the next 3 days, especially this question of emptiness. Give us a couple of days to go more deeply into it. How does one meditate on that which one has not understood? I guess my response to that good question is meditation is that process which facilitates understanding. That is why we meditate, so we can understand. So let me ask you something, B. You're a mother, and you have how many children?
Four.
Are they adopted, or are they your natural children? Your own children. So you gave birth to them. Good. Now let me ask you something. Let's say I wanted to learn about birth, right? And I went and read physiology, biology, right? Lots of accounts of the birth process. I read lots of first-person accounts by women of the birth process. I read accounts by the women who've given birth. I've read accounts by the OBGYN. I've read accounts by the OBGYN nurses and their accounts, right? I've read everything about birth, right? I've talked to many birth mothers. Let's say you have never read a thing about birth. Who's the expert on birth? You or I? No? Who knows birth better? You or I?
I'm able to keep track, but I do not really know.
I would say you know birth, the in and out of birth, because you have direct experience. And that direct experience is what Buddhism is about. Buddhism is only about experience. It is, what? So all you need is someone just to point out. If you're running around to all the experts going, I want to learn about birth, I want to learn about the birth process, right? You can get lots of explanations. But a good teacher would say to you, B, do you remember when you gave birth to your first child? That was birth. You already deeply have that experience in you. This is very important because we are 2,500 years from the Buddha, and we are many thousands of years, or hundreds of years, from many of the great masters and teachers that we read. And over the course of these thousands of years, a great body of philosophy, psychology, teaching has grown up in Buddhism. There is Buddhism. And there are many teachings and practices of the Buddha, many, many wonderful things. But they're all about one thing, experience. Right? If you have an intellectual understanding of the Four Noble Truths, but do not understand them from your experience, they have no capacity to help you. You want to have experience. You want to know within your own being, your own experience, your own life, what is the cause of my suffering? You want to experience the power of the teachings to liberate you from suffering. Again, just B, since you write so nicely, B's a mother for children, right? Now, it does not say, one cannot say that by reading books on parenting, right? One may get some helpful ideas or hints, right, about how to be a parent. But for those ideas to be effective, you have to practice them with your children. Right? There has to be experience. If there's no experience, then you're a talking head. But even more than that, if you have significant issues in your family and that you're reading about parenting to solve, if you do not implement them at home, and you just read the books and talk to your friends about them and chat online with other parents, is that going to change your home life? No. So every teaching of Buddhism is only about direct experience. We want to understand what these teachings are about beyond the level of words in the realm of direct experience. If we say, what is that? Again, I would say, we all know direct experience. It's what we experience when we're not thinking. Right? For example, let me take up another common experience, since we have men and women here, and birth may not be a common experience for everyone. There is a thing that is very popular in our world. It seems to be experienced by many people of all ages and types, economic, ethnic. It's called love. Right? We all know that thing, falling in love, being in love, right? It is an experience, isn't it? And it is hard to put in words, actually, even though people do. But when somebody's in it, they seem to know it, right? And when somebody has also been in it, when somebody says they're experiencing it, they go, oh, I know what they're going through. Right? one can, you know, put it in words and all that, but that's really doesn't describe the experience, does it? And we know that experience of believing you're in love or falling in love or whatever, whatever it is, changes people, right? While they're in love. They often act differently. And it often changes the way they relate to other people and issues and problems, right? It's an experience. Eating breakfast is an experience. Tasting food is an experience. Smelling food is an experience. Looking at each other is an experience. And at the truest sense, there are no words for it. For those of us who live in words, that may be confusing. But it is the truth. Need I say more? There is no word that can describe this. Impossible. This is just this. Look at this. This is the truth. If one, if someone is not here and you want to tell them about this, you may have to use words. But if someone is here and you want to talk to them about this, please send them to look at it, to smell it, to feel it. Don't give them words. In the same way, the Buddhist teachings are to be experienced. The nature of mind is to be experienced. The nature of thoughts to be experienced. The nature of emotions is to be experienced. The nature of impermanence is to be experienced. The nature of suffering is to be experienced. The nature of non-self is to be experienced. And that is what we are going to be doing. In Buddhism, there is a study path, a reflective path, an intellectual path, and there's a contemplative path. Right? Zen is very much in the contemplative tradition. That is why Bodhidharma, Zen, which comes from the Chan, Chana, is the Chinese for Dhyana. Dhyana is meditation. And that's what Bodhidharma was known for. The sutras, the Abhidhamma, many of the teachings, the devotional practices, the rituals, etc., were all known in China when Bodhidharma showed up. But what he noticed was meditation, especially meditation directly pointing to the nature of mind, was not being practiced. And his understanding was that is what the Buddha was about. That is the essence of Buddhism. Because that is what the Buddha awakened to. And that is the process the Buddha went through in his awakening. Let me spend a minute just talking about the path. Okay? Again, in this group of people here today, there are people doing different practices, different levels of practice. Some are fairly new, some are fairly old. The practice of vipassana, the practice of insight, is a body of teaching that one undertakes in the path of Buddhism. It is traditionally not a beginning. It is usually somewhat advanced. So there may be a few people saying, well, I'm not very advanced. That may be, but you're here. you sign up for this, it will benefit you. Your own capacity to practice them, and how deep you can practice them, the kind of results, will depend on lots of different things, which you will find out as you practice. The truth of reality is always available to us. It is not something that one has to go through by stages, because it is here. It is imminent in this reality that we are right in now. It is imminent in our minds. It is not outside of our present experience. That is the teaching of Buddha. That is what the Buddha discovered. Wonder of wonders, he said, in this body is the waxing and waning of everything. Everything. All his teachings, all his wisdom, all his understanding, he found in only one place, by deep introspection into his own mind. Looking deeply. And looking deeply into reality. That is the place. That was his mind, M-I-N-E. And he said, we all have that same mind. There was nothing unique to him. So this is faith in our tradition. This is the deep faith. Okay? Other religious traditions, you put faith outside yourself. You put faith in a deity, a supreme deity, or deities, or something like that. That is where you put your faith, and that is where you expect your salvation will come from. Your liberation will come from. But that is not the path of Buddhism. There's a phrase, liberation in the palm of your hand. It means what? It's right here. We just have to wake up to it. Traditionally, in the Buddhist path, as a path, there is some grounding in some basic tenets that help us understand the nature of our human life, such as the Four Noble Truths. We contemplate that. We contemplate impermanence. We contemplate loving kindness, bodhicitta. There are various things we contemplate, the preciousness of human life. We contemplate these things not because it has anything to do with the truth or awakening or seeing clearly our true nature, our Buddha nature. It has to do with kind of getting our act together. Right? So we are not so totally delusively attached and involved in endless worldly pursuits looking for happiness always over here. Right? That's what all those teachings, those are wonderful teachings to help us loosen our grasp on our delusive, pain-producing way of life that we think is correct. Right? So all those preliminary types of practices and reflections and understandings and studies are very helpful for doing that. So I think they are very worthy of continual study in meditation. But in the meditative path of Buddhism, there are really three major rivers. Mindfulness, calm abiding or single point of concentration, and insight. What most of us practice, let's say in the Thich Nhat Hanh tradition, is mindfulness and concentration, calm abiding. We learn to be mindful, which means we learn to be present to whatever is going on. When walking, I'm walking. When sitting, I know I'm sitting. When eating, I know I'm eating. When I'm looking at Jim, I know I'm looking at Jim. When I look at Angie, I know I'm looking at Angie. You know, I learn to be present to what's in front of me, to what my six consciousnesses are involved in. Whether I'm seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching, feeling, or even thinking, I bring mindfulness to that. Mindfulness turns on the light, so at least we see clearly. We get out of our heads, get out of our world of projections, get out of the world of complexes, and have some capacity to see what reality is, what I'm experiencing right now. That's mindfulness. Okay. Concentration, which is often translated as calm abiding, right, is the next step, is by taking the mind, and as opposed to a general kind of mindfulness of whatever being present, but learning to keep the mind focused on one thing, what begins to happen? The mind quiets down. The mind calms down. It becomes more peaceful. It becomes more open. It becomes more stable. It becomes more unified. And there are many wonderful benefits in that. Personal benefits is, one is generally what? Happier. Because the mind is no longer caught up in all its neurotic, afflictive, distracted, traditional kind of movement. It's just in the moment, very present, not always running through conceptualization. Right? And the focused mind is very energetic. The light is very light. But the practice of mindfulness and the practice of calm abiding will not liberate us. This is something that is often very disturbing to us. Because many people really practice for one reason. And that is what? They want a more peaceful life. They want a more peaceful mind. And they don't like their thoughts. So they practice these practices in order to get rid of their thoughts, or their involvement of thoughts, or attraction of thoughts. But the problem is, this practice will not liberate us. Because, why? Because when we get up from our meditation, when we get out of retreat, and we enter the world of activity again, where everything is bustling about and moving around, and people like us and don't like us, and we have success and failure, and right? All of a sudden, what do we find? What happens to our peace? Our calmness? Gone. And we're right back into the muck. So while there are great benefits to the practice of mindfulness, there are great benefits to the practice of single point of concentration, calm abiding, these practices in and of themselves will not free us from our suffering. And this was the experience of the Buddha. Please understand, this goes back to the time of the Buddha. Because he practiced with most of the major meditative teachers of his day, and most of them were teaching trance. They were teaching how to develop meditative concentration to the extent that they would have all kinds of incredible, wonderful, meditative, contemplative experiences that were incredibly, experiences of non-self, but they just wouldn't feel any self, just incredible joy and peace. and openness, sulfur disappear, etc., etc., right? But when they arose from their meditation, you know, and had to deal with the annoyances of life, they still responded in the old way. Their conditioning was only temporarily abated by their meditative experience. But it wasn't uprooted. That is why the Buddha went his own way. Eventually. Went his own way. And where did he go? Right? He went within. Within what? Within his own mind, which means his own experience. And he just looked deeply, deeply into the who and what of who and what he was. And that is something that all of us have the capacity to do, because it is that deep looking into the nature of reality, the nature of mind, the nature of thought, the nature of self, that produces the wisdom that has the power to liberate. Nothing else does. That which really separates Buddhism from most other paths is its emphasis on this awakening into the nature of reality, the nature of self. That this really has the capacity to free us, because now we understand really what's going on. So, any questions so far? Yes. Yes. That is where a teacher comes in, right? So the teacher gives us a practice, a meditative practice, and says, B, you do this practice in this way, and you will have this kind of experience. In the meditative tradition, if you're at, that is the way, all right? And that is why when we take refuge, right, in Buddha, Dharma, Sangha, we are taking refuge because we know that we don't have all the answers and we don't have all the understanding. And we are looking to a body of teaching and practice and a teacher who will help show us the way in this life. So we will understand, right? The teacher is pointing us so we will have that experience. Okay. So you find your body changing and you don't know what's going on. And you, well, we just finished, okay? And you go and you don't know what's happening. Right? And you go to your friend and she says to you, B, you're pregnant. Before you didn't know what was going on inside you, right? And they say, oh, you're pregnant. Now you know what's going on. But you haven't given birth yet, have you? So, but your friend, or your OBGYN, or whoever it is, will tell you how the process will unfold over the next 8 or 9 months. So at least you have an understanding of how things will unfold. But you haven't had given birth yet, have you? But if you follow the directions of the person who is guiding you, if you have someone, everything will move in that direction and you will eventually have that experience. That's the path of meditation when you work with a teacher. And that's the, you know, that's why we, you know, that's why we have teachers in anything, right? You know, I'm always, you know, using musical analogy. You know, when you first sit down the piano, right? It makes terrible sounds. Right? You cannot play, can you? All you can do is elicit terrible sounds. But if you have a teacher, your teacher will say, Fred, if you practice like this and practice like this and do this and do this and do this every day, blah, 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 you know, in time you will make music on this piano. Now that's not my experience yet, is it? Whose experience is it? The teacher's. It's not my experience. That is the trust we have to have in Buddha, Dharma, Sangha, and the teacher. Right? That's the trust. If we don't have the trust, it's very difficult to make progress, right? Because we don't have the experience yet. But this trust in the teacher, this trust in the mentor, this trust in the guide is in everything. Anything we want to do where we step out, where we look to somebody else to guide us based on their experience, it is no different. Right? Think about anything you undertake. Right? We believe, if we are going to stay stuck within the realm simply of what we know, we will never change. It is only when, for whatever reason, it has come to us that we no longer want to continue the way we're continuing. And we want to do it differently. We want to live differently. But I don't know how to do it. Why? Because it's not my own experience yet. I have to what? Seek out someone who's done it. Now, again, because of technology, we can access books, we can access videos, we can access lots of that stuff. But that still, I don't think, has replaced living teachers. That's my own experience. Because living teachers, when you have that direct encounter, we believe in the possibilities of transformation when we encounter someone who has done it. And that's faith. Faith in Buddhism means trust. And that's what the Buddha said to his disciples. He said, I can't do it for you. All I can say is I have walked the way, and this has been my experience, and I can tell you about that, and I can assure you that if you walk this way, you will have these experiences too. I cannot say that your journey will be the same as mine. I cannot say how long it'll take, but I can assure you that it will occur if you practice. You will have these experiences. Yes. Such as?
I'm thinking about this. I go to see this. He puts needle in me.
Mm-hmm.
I feel better. Mm-hmm. I don't understand at all.
Mm.
But I'm living an experience. I've shared this experience with people when they say, this I am just, they say, no.
Right.
It's your imagination. Your
mind. Right.
I can't explain, but I live the experience, and I feel better. She may be known why I feel better. She could explain to me, but it's for me, it would mean a thing.
Right.
Because it's what I feel, what I experience, that makes me believe that acupuncture is good for me. That's what I
want
to
say. Good. You are absolutely right. When one has an authentic experience, it is truth. Right? And people can say to you, everything else doesn't work, isn't working well, but it doesn't matter. Because you know, for you, this is your truth. Because you have direct experience. This is important to understand. We have to get out of our heads and have direct experience. No smoking. In the body of meditation that is referred to as vipassana, it has to do with true seeing, higher seeing, seeing into the nature of reality. And traditionally in the Buddhist path, there are kind of two paths, and we're going to kind of combine them, because that's been my own experience. But one path is more analytically based, and one path is more direct experience based. But they both really lead to the same place, and they just involve different processes. So today and tomorrow I'm going to read from kind of a more analytical, investigative teaching. And then the last 2 days I'll be reading from the great Japanese Zen master Hakuin. Will give a sense of direct experience. And we will be practicing. I will not guarantee, say that in 4 days everyone will here have complete liberation. But I hope you'll get a taste of these practices and some experience in them. I know that some of you, many of you, I'm not sure, are in the upcoming 4 month retreat, which is will be a continuation of the teachings that begun today. This is called the wheel of investigation and meditation that thoroughly purifies mental activity. Nyingma Rinpoche actually lived in the 19th century and actually there were among the older Tibetans that came out of Tibet in the 50s, there were some that had encountered him as very young children. He was still alive. There certainly were, until recently, disciples of his still alive. He is one of the great teachers of Eastern Tibet in the 19th century. He was considered a living Buddha. The wheel of investigation and meditation that thoroughly purifies mental activity. This is a meditation text. So there's not a lot of teaching. It's more about practice, and we're going to do this together. Okay? So he begins by saying, Namo Manjushri, Jushri Ye. He invokes Manjushri. You know, in the morning, oh, by the way, did I forget to introduce the Buddha? Forgive me. So this is Bodhidharma, but this is Shakyamuni Buddha. And two of his disciples, monastic disciples, Dukliyana and Sariputra, two elders of his Sangha. And he is sitting in the earth-touching pose, the pose he took at the time of his enlightenment under the Bodhi tree in India. And you know, in the morning when we do the earth touchings, we remember and pay respects to the Buddha, Shakyamuni Buddha, the historical Buddha, as well as we pay respect to these various bodhisattvas, these emanations of enlightened action. Right? How do we act in the world? How do we manifest our awakened energy in the world? We manifest it as a Valakishvara, right? Compassion, love. We manifest it as Samantha Bahadra, endlessly active and energetically active to help sentient beings. And we manifest it as Nipam Rinpoche is saying, as Manjusri. Manjusri is the Bodhisattva of wisdom. Maybe you see pictures, sculptures, paintings of Manjusri. He wields a sword, right? And he carries a text. The text he carries is the Heart Sutra, the Prajnaparamita Sutra, which we chant the Heart Sutra in the morning. That is his special sutra. And the sword is the sword of wisdom. It's a special sword. It cuts through delusion. It cuts away delusion. It cuts away wrong ideas. It cuts away neurotic fixations. It cuts away attachments and aversions. It cuts away our attachment to self. Cuts away our narcissism and self-interest. Cuts it all away. But how does he do it? With his wisdom. With his understanding. So it is Manjusri that Nipam Rinpoche invokes. Praising, honoring Manjusri, the Bodhisattva of wisdom. And those of you who've been around a while know that he has this other capacity with his sword. It is called the sword that cuts in one. Most swords cut things in two, but his special sword cuts through duality and makes things whole. So it's a special sword. If you can order one from Dharma Crafts or one of the online Dharma stores. So, there's an opening verse that says, whatever problems there are in the world are created by the afflictions in our own mind. A mistaken attitude is the cause for the kleshas. Yet the pattern of our thoughts can be refined. So he's acknowledging there are a lot of problems in the world, but he is narrowing the causation, obviously because this is where we're going to be looking. They're created by the afflictions in our own mind. This is... this is something very important. This is not denying that social, economic, etc., conditions don't contribute in many ways to the problems of the world. But it acknowledges at the base, the world is made up of human beings. And human beings are acting from their minds. Where does war begin? Who makes war? People make war. So before one acts and goes to war, there has to be, and this is, you can study how we end up going to war, for thousands of years, it's always the same thing. Right? People have to feel wronged, people have to whatever, and people have to be told there's an enemy, and people have to get angry at the enemy, and hate the enemy, and eventually want to kill the enemy, and then go about doing that. But it begins in the mind. People don't just get up in the morning and go off to war. There has to be that impulse that is coming from their own minds. So all the afflictions of the world, the injustices of the world, the indifference that people have to other people and their suffering, this is all coming from our minds. Again, this is not denying lots of other causations and conditions that contribute to that, but it's basically understanding that it's most fundamental. Human beings are creating their own problems, their own suffering. This is, I think, what inspires us, those of us who want a better world, right? A nobler world, a kinder world, a more altruistic world, etc., etc., why we are here, doing what we're doing. This is not denying, working for social causes and social transformation and betterment in all the many ways that we all go about it. This is not denying that, but it's understanding that fundamentally the transformation will only deeply occur in this world when human beings transform the nature of their mind. When interconnection is not just a thought. When we are all one is not just a thought, but an experience. It's easy to say, we are the world. Anybody can say we are the world. Parrots can say we are the world. Parrots can say love one another. But it must be experienced to be real. Or else it's just a thought. And thoughts, as we will look at over these next days, are not very dependable. They are here and then they are gone. Right? They stay in our consciousness briefly. Right? And if they are not grounded in experience, they do not have any transformative power in our life. I was talking to somebody a couple weeks ago, I forget what we were talking about, but somehow it reminded me of an experience I had with Thich Nhat Hanh many years ago, where I had been to visit a Vietnamese temple. I think we must have been in Paris in those days. He couldn't go there. He was kind of personal non grata in the Vietnamese community in the 70s in Paris. And when I came back to where he lived, he asked me what I had seen there, and I told him about seeing a quite large statue of Kuan Yin, the Bodhisattva of Compassion, which holds a very prominent place within the pantheon of Vietnamese Buddhism. As other Mahayana countries too. And he mentioned how in Vietnamese Buddhism it is lay people spend a lot of energy worshipping Kuan Yin, right? Going before Kuan Yin, bowing before Kuan Yin, making offerings to Kuan Yin, invoking the name of Kuan Yin, or the mantra of Kuan Yin, right? And he said to me, yeah, that's okay. Kind of like, that's okay as far as it goes. And he looked me in the eye and he said, Fred, Do you want to know the best way, the best offering to make to Kuan Yin? So I said, of course. And he just held up his hands. He said, this is the best offering you can make to Kuan Yin. You want to make an offering to Kuan Yin, the Bodhisattva of compassion? Be a compassionate person. Right? Act in a compassionate way with everybody you encounter. Right? The Dalai Lama has been asked the same question, and he'll say, yes, you know, much rather to involve yourself in compassionate actions than say, Om Mani Padme Hum, over and over again. That does not deny that saying mantras and things like that or various deities may not be beneficial in many ways, but that will not make you a compassionate person. If you want to be a compassionate person and truly make an offering to the Bodhisattva of compassion, be compassionate experientially. Right? This is very important. Because Buddhism has become encrusted, has become ossified with practices that often have nothing to do with the actual experience of what the practices are about. This is the power of Zen. This is the power of Dzogchen. This is the power of the contemplative meditative traditions. This is the power of Bodhidharma. When the Emperor Wu says to Bodhidharma, you know, when he enumerates all the good acts he's done to earn merit, he says, well, haven't I been a great and meritorious Buddhist? And Bodhidharma says, absolutely not. Emperor Wu had a big ego. All his meritorious actions only made his ego bigger. Big Buddhist ego. Big Buddhist self. For lots of people, their spiritual practice only makes their self more reified because they think there's a self that's doing all this and there's a self that's getting lots of merit. This is not what the Buddha taught. Whatever problems there are in the world are created by the afflictions in our own minds. A mistaken attitude is the cause for the kleshas. Yet the pattern of our thoughts can be refined. The kleshas are all the afflictive emotions. Right? So, we could say our true mind, our natural mind, our Buddha mind, whatever you want to call it, the reason we don't experience it is because it is covered. Right? It's sort of like this, you know. Right? We don't see the grapefruit, right? Why? Because it's covered. Does that mean the grapefruit isn't here? Somebody might say, what? Andrew might, if he didn't know there was something behind it, Andrew might say, what? I just see a paper. I don't know what Fred's talking about. Right? Grapefruit. What's he talking about? Right? But there is a grapefruit here. But Andrew doesn't see it because all he sees is the paper. And that's understandable. Because that's all he sees. Because the grapefruit is covered. Right? So the Buddha has seen the grapefruit. And he didn't just see it once. It is a living reality to him. And he goes to Andrew's house and says, Andrew, you have a grapefruit in your house. And Andrew says, what's he talking about? That's not my experience. Right? All I see is paper. That's his experience, isn't it? So we have a clash, don't we, Andrew? And for Andrew to believe that there is a grapefruit under here, and to believe there is a very practical way of taking the paper off to not only see the grapefruit, but also to eat it and enjoy it, he has to what? Believe his guess, doesn't he? And, you know, come back to what we said earlier, some people trust is easy, some people trust is hard. Right? You don't trust. And that could be good in some areas. Buddha said, to his disciples, keep your eye on me. Don't just take what I say just because I'm the Buddha, or because you respect or love me. Also test it through your experience. That's what the practice is about. We test it through our experience. Right? You have your teacher, you have your mentor, you have your guide, tries to set you for a path that you can achieve what you want to achieve, which has not been your experience. And then along the way, you begin to see whether that is valid or not, what you're being said. Okay? A mistaken attitude is the cause for kleshas. So this is what's covering. This is why we do not see, and experience our true nature, our Buddha nature, this totally open-hearted, totally wise, intelligent, boundaryless, birthless, deathless aspect of our own mind. Why don't we experience it? Because we are caught up, what? In the reality of our neuroses, in the reality of our fixations, in the reality of our conceptualizations, in the reality of our delusions, in the reality of our unending drama of emotionality. Sound familiar? That's the reality of most people. And that is covering our true mind. It does not mean, forgive me, for crumpling up your paper. Right? Some people might say, right? Absolutely wrong. Right? No such thing as a grapefruit. Right? Most worldly people, that's what they say, because all they see is what? The words, the paper, their own self-image and their own narcissist. Always just sees themselves. It is only those who look deeply, vipassana. Right? Only those who look deeper than the world of appearances who will find the grapefruit. Find the grapefruit where? Right here. Andrew does not have to leave his home. That's not the message of the Buddha. The Buddha doesn't say to Andrew, go forth, Andrew. 1,000 miles away, you will find a grapefruit tree. The Buddha says, no, it's right here. It's just covered by the kleshas. It's covered by your wrong notions and thoughts. Learn to look deeply, deeper than. Look into, investigate, right? And you will see what we're talking about. Problems that are in the world are created by the afflictions in our own minds. A mistaken attitude is the cause for the kleshas. Yet the pattern of our thoughts can be refined. This is important. the pattern of our thoughts can be refined, or can be refined, and we will discover gold. Why do we discover gold? Because the gold has always been there in the ore. This is, again, forgive me for repeating myself, but I repeat myself because it is so important. This is something, if we are going to follow this path, we need to believe and accept on faith. No matter how O-R-E, like you feel, in essence, you are gold. And that you don't have to make it. You don't have to find it. It is already here. You just have to go through a process of transformation. Or better say, just a process of uncovering. That's a better way to say it. Just need to uncover it. The pattern of our thoughts can be refined. Right. The wheel of investigation and meditation, the wheel what? Wheel is always turning. Right? We need to turn the wheel another way. We've always been turning it this way. And what's been turning the wheel? Self. Ego. Me and my and I, right? That's been turning my wheel. And every experience I have and every pattern I thought is all based on what? Me. My needs, my wants, my likes, my dislikes, my getting happiness, right? My getting what I want, right? That's been turning this wheel. We want to turn it another way. Are we clear so far? Because the next section is how to meditate. Good. Everybody waking up a little bit? You know, if you get sleepy, wake yourself up. Sit up straight. Take a deep breath. Go bang your head against the wall a few times. I used to do things like that. Go throw water on your face, cold water on your face. Go outside, rub the snow on your face. It's a little hard in Florida. Wake yourself up. Contemplate death. Which is, that is one of the tried and true methods to deal with sleepiness in meditation. Think of death. Think of, you don't know how long you're going to be alive. Do you? None of us know how long we're going to live. That's, again, one of our delusions. We think we're going to live forever. We think we're permanent. We're going to be looking at that today. It's not true. We're all just guests. And death could come at any moment. And it's not death. Certainly change could come. Right? There are people who signed up retreat and within last week couldn't come to retreat. Why? Because of impermanence. Permanence of work, somebody got sick, somebody this, that. Right? You think, oh, I'll sign up here, I'm going to retreat. No. We don't know. We don't know anything. So that wakes us up. That energizes us. So, how to meditate. Section 1. Imagine someone who stirs in you intense attachment, and consider them now present vividly before you. Separate this person into five component skandhas and begin by investigating the physical body. So what we're going to be dealing with today is five skandhas. and the five skandhas are? Our Buddhist experts, where are they? Form,
feeling,
perception, and consciousness. Okay, and you might have heard them recited this morning in the Heart Sutra. There are various ways that Buddhist Abhidhamma psychology looks at what is a being, but one of the major ways is that a being, and that's us, and everyone we know, is composed of five skandhas, five aggregates, five heaps, five things. Okay, and you put them together, and you have a human being. So what we're beginning to do in our wheel of investigation, we are investigating. Okay, this is important. Okay, so I want to define for a moment what our modus operandi is for the next 4 days. We are investigators, and we will be investigating things we have always taken for granted. Already in the brief interviews I had this morning, we already got into that with a number of people. We just talk nonsense to each other, right? Me, I, you, thoughts, and memories, and, you know, absolute garbage. And we never stop and go, what am I saying, and what does this really mean? Is there such a thing as memory? Is there such a thing as mind? Is there such a thing as I? Do thoughts really exist? Right? Are things permanent or impermanent? Are things of substance or they have no substance? Right? So we need to look deeply into these issues and investigate the nature of our experience. So, there are these five sweeps. And the first is form, which is, for us, would be body. Okay? Now, this, there's a reason, you know, we start with body and form. One, it is most obvious, right? Because it's form. It has a kind of solidity that makes it much more apparent to us than sensations and feelings. Again, we will show later are very obvious too, but body is most obvious, form is most obvious, most apparent to the senses. But also, it is body, as human beings, is what we are most identify ourselves with. Think about your life. And think about the activities of your life. 95% of it is about your body. Right? Why do you have a house? Does your mind need a house? No. You have a house what? For your body. Why do you bathe? You bathe for your mind? You bathe what? Body. Right? Why do you buy clothes? Your body. Why do you look in the mirror? Everything just Christ. You're doing it for your body. Right? Why are you saving for your retirement? Because you're worried what's going to happen to your body. Right? What's going to happen to my body when it gets older? Who's going to take care of it? How can I feed it? Right? You go shopping every day, right? You're shopping all the week. What are you shopping for? Your mind? You're shopping for your body. We are the slaves of our body. Right? You know, you talk to old people these days, some of them are getting older, all they talk about is what? Their life is what? Doctor visits. And this is not the psychiatrist. It's all about what? The aches and pains and diseases of what? Our body. So, we are definitely body-centric. And so much of our life and concern is about making things comfortable and easy for what? Our bodies. Why do we take vitamins and supplements? For our bodies. Keep them healthy. So I need to belabor the point. A hell of a lot of our energy and our life and our work and our activity accumulation is all focused on our body. Because that is probably the prime identification, right, with the I. We identify ourselves as our body, and then secondarily we identify ourselves as a mind, and then probably the third that puts it all together, we identify with name, right? The name that we put to the body and mind. But for most of us, most of our activity is involved in the body. So that is why, let us begin with the body. So he says, imagine someone who stirs in you intense attachment, and consider them now vividly before you. Separate this person into five component skandhas, and begin by investigating the physical body. Consider all its interior substances, the flesh and blood, bones, marrow, fat, internal organs, limbs and organs of sense, feces, urine, bacteria, hair, nails, and the like. And think of the... This is very important. Right? We look at other bodies and we go, ooh, beautiful body. I'd like to get to know that body. Now, so you take someone, right, who you visualize, could be yourself or could be someone else, and you are, you like their body. You are attracted to their body. Okay? All right? Now, if I said, okay, you love their body, don't you? I know you do. So let's really investigate this body that you are so attracted to and attached to. It could be your own, right? And let's just open it up. We're investigators, right? We're investigators. Investigators are not afraid of looking deeply. So let's open the body up, and what do we find? Oh, let's take out a liver. What do you say, Jim? Attractive? Take a whiff. And Jim goes, what? Disgusting. Smells terrible. Hold on a second. A minute ago you said that was the object of your desire. That when you see that body coming, you get just filled with all kinds of things. But now when we look more deeply, you know, you like this skin? Well, let's take it off and let's say I showed you the inside of it. What would you say? It is the body, isn't it? The intestines, so we just stretch out all the intestines. How long is an intestine? They're long, aren't they? 24 yards. So let's just stretch out an intestine. Alright. A lot of times people don't like this meditation today. Why? Because it undermines what? The way we see things. This practice is about that. If it doesn't turn us about, if it doesn't make us see things differently, it's not doing its work. Okay. Consider all the impure substances, the flesh and blood, bones, marrow, fat, internal organs, limbs and organs of sense, feces, urine, bacteria, hair, nails, and the like. That means all your body. How many body parts are there? Anyhow, take them all out and look at them. Contemplate them, smell them, feel them. Tell me what's so attractive about it. And the components of earth and other elements. So the body in a traditional way is considered composed of the elements of earth, fire, air, and water. So it's another way of looking at it. Think of all these aspects, each of which can still be divided further, down to the tiniest article. Right? The tiniest article would be what? Cells, tissues, what is it? Tissues, cells, atoms made up of, subatomic particles that are made up of, quarks, quirks, quirky quirks. Look deeply. Mentally dissect them all stage by stage, checking whether you feel desire for each in turn. This is very important. What do you say, Jung? You have desire for those subatomic particles? We laugh. Yesterday I did a little experiment. We were having lunch here, and some of the people at lunch were talking about desserts and how they were going to be very careful at this retreat because they know that Roxanne often puts out desserts, that they were going to only eat one dessert or two desserts. They were very regulated. And there were cookies out there yesterday that people were very interested in. So later on the day, I did a little experiment, and the people were in a group, and I came in with a cookie. And I said, look at this cookie. Does anybody have any desire for this cookie? Any yearning for this cookie? Anybody like to eat this cookie? And of course, if you like cookies and attracted to cookies, you would say what? Yes. Sally goes, yes. Okay? Then I took the cookie. It was on a plate. I picked the cookie up. And I went like that. I crumbled it. And all of a sudden, it was just a heap of crumbs. Sally, would you like this? And Sally goes, what? No. Sally goes, I'll pass. Well, what's different? It's the same stuff, isn't it? As a cookie, we just changed the form. What's changed? But all of a sudden it's not appetite. It's not an object of desire. It's not something you think about or care about or want or need, is it? I want you to be this kind of investigator over these next 4 days. You need to look deeply into all these things that you do and desire and need and want, including the self that wants all these things, and go, what is really there? Still a cookie, just in a different form. But all of a sudden we have no desire, right? Still the object of your desire, but now you're seeing him or her from the inside. And you go, ooh, I don't want that. Right? Why is that? You need to look deeply and have your own experience so that you gain the aim of vipassana or investigatory practice, deep looking practice, is only one thing. Insight, wisdom. But wisdom that has the power to produce change. Because one sees differently. Okay. Mentally dissect them all stage by stage, checking whether you feel desire for each in turn. Since there is nothing that we could call body, bodies in quotes, apart from these substances, varied and impure, body is nothing but an unclean contraption, a bundle of muscles and fibers, a mound of waste, and seething fluids that ooze and trickle. Deeply upsetting to people. That's all our body is. Nothing but an unclean contraption, a bundle of muscles and fibers, a mound of waste, and seething fluids that ooze and trickle. Shall I read it again? I think I will. Since there is nothing we could call body, apart from these substances, varied and impure, a body is nothing but an unclean contraption, a bundle of muscles and fibers, a mound of waste, and seething fluids that ooze and trickle, seeing this fact, sit and consider it mindfully. Okay. This is the contemplative part. Right? Once you have dissected, once you have looked at all of this, seeing the fact of what you are now seeing, not because you've read some teaching about the body, but because you've actually looked deeply, experientially, into the nature of the of form, in this case the body, sit and consider mindfully what you now understand about bodies. Is that clear? This is a meditation that one does over and over again, until one gets the fact of what one has experienced. Once the momentum of this insight fades, turn to feelings, perceptions, formations, and consciousness, and look into their nature by dividing them into their various aspects. So the same way we did with the body, we now do with the other five senses. When you see them as insubstantial, like bubbles, a mirage, a plantain tree, or a magical illusion, you will understand how in these two, there is nothing to which one could ever be attached. So, body is extremely important because, as I said earlier, that is probably the primary place of ego attachment, right? So when somebody says, Fred, you know, Fred, you're, or somebody says, so-and-so thinks you're a creep, Fred. Right? Let's say somebody says that. Now, what gets offended? Does my body get offended? Because somebody called me a creep? Does the realm of sensation, feeling, positive, negative get affected? Thoughts get affected? So all of a sudden all the thoughts come together and go, what? So-and-so is calling me a creep? My mental formations? Is it my consciousness? My faculties, my awareness? And what's going on here? Right. So we want to investigate all the realms of the five skandhas. When you see them as insubstantial, like bubbles, a mirage, a plantain tree, a magical illusion, you will understand how these, in these two, there is nothing to which one could ever be attached. So, in the realm of the second skandha, there is healing. Sensations. Whenever one of our senses, eye, ear, nose, tongue, body, mind, makes contact with an object, there is an experience, right? Positive, negative, or neutral. What is going on in this experience? Is there anything that we can be attached to? How long does the feeling last? What is the nature of this experience? Should I keep doing it forever? Is it worth killing for? Is it worth pushing somebody else out of the way so I can get here first? What's really going on here? What is the nature of eating? A lot of people have all kinds of food issues, don't they? What's really going on when you eat? You have a sensation in your mouth, a taste. You have something, your eyes see something, your mouth tastes something, maybe your nose smells something. The sensations that are positive, negative, and neutral that arise in all these contexts of senses with some sense objects, how long do they last? And what is the nature of these experiences? Are they worth thinking about, planning about, avoiding, developing all kinds of strategies about. You tell me when you examine the nature of your experience in the realm of feeling, in the realm of thought, in the realm of mental formation, and in the realm of just pure consciousness, aware of something. Continue with this thought until it fades, and once it does, do not try to prolong it, but turn instead to another investigation. Reflect deeply on how these aggregates, which are impure and lack real essence, do not remain once they've arisen, but perish from one moment to the next. All the civilizations and societies of the past met only with destruction at the end, and so will those of today and ages yet to come. The nature of the condition can inspire disenchantment. Death is certain for all living things. Suddenly it comes, and without warning, reflect on the whole. All that we experience is changing from one moment to the next. In summary, to the best of your ability, consider all aspects of impermanence that characterize conditioned things. Okay. Recognize how the aggregates of those we desire are transient as lightning, evanescent like bubbles, fleeting like clouds in the sky. Until the momentum of this idea fades, focus your attention on nothing else. Basically, as we look to all five skandhas, all these aspects of experience, we're looking at a number of things. Obviously, in the body, we're looking purity and impurity. We're looking, is there an essence, or is it just a matter of composite of things? We're looking for the impermanence, and we're looking for the suffering. In Buddhism, this is often called the three marks of existence. Right? Permanence, anicca, dukkha, suffering, and anatma, no self or nothing of substance. But rather than teaching about, we are going to experience it by deeply looking into our five skandhas to see. You know, the nature of suffering is interesting. You know, how do we say that everything contains suffering? Hmm? Which is a fundamental teaching of the Buddha. So we have bodies, right? And certainly bodies have the capacity of giving us a pleasure, don't they? And yet, at the same time, our body is a magnet for suffering. Hmm? It suffers significantly from disease. Illness. It suffers significantly from, endless little things that bother it. Right? I mean, you know, we'll get a little pinprick and we'll suffer. We'll get a little thorn, a little splinter. Right? And we will suffer. Right? We'll have a little acid indigestion. Our bodies will suffer. And that which we thought was the source of our pleasure, right? All that delicious food, all those rich foods that we just oodled over, didn't we? Right? And all those sweets that we just had to have are now what? A source of suffering to us. And how we feel in our bodies. Right? And they could be the source of disease. Right? Clogging our arteries, putting on weight, you know. We need to look deeply at what we're doing here, guys. So we need to see how thoughts, mental formations, feelings, right? So feelings can give us great pleasure, right? We can look at beautiful things, right? Looking at flowers. Right? So this is in the realm of consciousness, right, and feeling. This is giving us happiness, right? But when we come back 3 days and it's all faded, it can give us what? Sadness. Loss. Right? Falling in love can be a source of great happiness. How is falling out of love? Coming together can give us great happiness. How does separation and loss, how do we deal with that? So everything is a source of potential suffering. This is what the Buddha said. coming together implies at some point there'll be what? Parting. Success implies what? At some point there'll be failure. Being liked implies what? Potential of being disliked. So in each of the skandhas, suffering is present. And again, this is not to bum you out. For those of you who are bummed out, this is not to depress you. This is about looking clearly, right? Vipassana is insight, the higher view, or as Thich Nhat Hanh says, the deeper looking. We need to look under the surface, right? Under the appearance of things. How do bodies appear? Beautiful. Right? Very attractive. Right? That's how they look. And yet when we look deeply, we'll see what? There's another side. We have to balance. This is not about disgust. This is about balance. Right? So when you see the beautiful cookie, you also see it all smushed up into crumbs. You know that is its nature. It's just made up of composite things, right? What's in a cookie? Flour, sugar, water, butter, eggs, right? Chocolate, you know, so if it's all, you know, if it's all smushed out there, right? Do you find it so attractive? Right? I mean, you know what I mean? And you go around with your fingers going, I put my finger in the flour, then dip it over here in the sugar, and mix it up in a little egg, and you laugh, because why? It doesn't seem delicious, does it? Your dog might find it delicious. Right? Which brings up another whole area. One person's attraction is another person's disgust. It's all just relative. We're just conditioned. And we don't see clearly. The practice of insight is to help us begin to see clearly. Again, what we're dealing with in the next couple of days is this analytical meditation, where we really use our analytical powers now to see more clearly what's going on. And we'll see in 2 days when we deal with Hakuin that there's another much more direct way of perceiving all this. I think they go well together. I think a lot of the analytical stuff that's in this text kind of softens the ground. That then makes the more direct way much easier. So this is my recommendation. This is how you do Vipassana practice, in at least the way I've been taught it. So you have a meditation, let's say formal meditation, right? Let's say your meditation is 35 minutes, okay? First 5 or 10 minutes, you just do calm abiding practice. You calm, stabilize, clear the mind. Okay? And then you begin an investigation such as this. You visualize a form, your own form or somebody's form that you're really attracted to, or anything, you know. You could take a flower, I'd kill for this flower, right? And then in your mind, just take it apart. You know, would you kill for this, this little piece here? If all the pieces were laid out, would you still kill for it? Is it the stem you'd kill for? No. Right? What is it that you really are attracted to? Would you still be attracted to it in 3 days? And if you wouldn't, how deep is your attraction? So you begin with 5 or 10 minutes of breath practice, stabilizing the mind. Then you very clearly begin a line of investigation, whether it's a form, feeling, whether it's a mental formation, memory, whatever it is. And you use the way we've talked about to analyze it into its parts, to look at its impermanence, to look at if it's a category of impurity, of suffering, etc. Okay? The usual instructions are exhaust the inquiry. Exhaust the inquiry does not mean get exhausted. It means do it fully. When you feel you've exhausted it, right? You've kind of gone over it so much that you kind of see something clearly. Then rest and relax the mind for the last 5 or 10 minutes. And that's how you practice. So when you do this investigation, it is very concentrated. I mean, bring your mindfulness and your samatha into practice. Samatha meaning your single point of concentration. You know, you can be outside and go, oh, what a beautiful tree. I mean, that's the way human beings talk, by the way. You know, we talk that way to each other. Oh, look at that beautiful tree. Is that? You could take off the leaves, spread them all out, take off the branches, take off the trunk, lay it all out. Is it still a tree? What is it? Could look at the tree and then we look over to another tree. A minute ago we really liked that tree. I could sit here forever looking at that tree. And then 5 minutes later we're looking at another tree. We haven't even thought of that tree. How often do we do that? How many things have we desired? How many things have we attached to that we've never given a thought since? Thousands, millions. And then they say, don't call it a tree, what is it? A tree is just a label, by the way. An imputation. And we won't even get into that which is looking, that's coming. Yes. Again, eating all, so, let me just say, so just to be clear. So, formal meditation, you get how to divide up your meditation period. But again, when you're eating, when you're walking, when you're looking, keep this investigatory mind alive. What's really going on here? What am I looking at? And break things into your parts. Beautiful tree. What if it fell over on your beloved? Crushed them. Would you still say beautiful tree? Now it's become what? Source of suffering. Why? Impermanence. The tree is not going to be there forever, is it? Always standing like that. Causes and conditions. Everything's unstable. So this is, again, this is vipassana. This is dhyana. Looking deeply. Looking under appearance to see what's... We don't... If you just look at something with your everyday mind, you won't see impermanence. You won't see the nature of suffering. You won't see the component parts, right? Because it looks, it appears a certain way. This is why this practice is essential for the cultivating wisdom. Right? Remember Little Red Riding Hood? I've said about that before. It may look like grandma, but it's not grandma. But you better look deeply, right? If you don't pick up the 90. Right? We are fooled by appearance. I mean, we'll get to the self. There appears to be a self. We'll deal with that one, but let's begin on the easy ones. Yes, David.
I was just going to ask about the last three temples. So, it was interesting to use the word attachment when you kind of going from one tree and admire 5 minutes and then go to another tree after that. And all of a sudden that becomes the most interesting to but in what is the difference between it? Personally, my first thought was, well, attachment, not lingering on the tree necessarily, it's kind of just a moment of inspiration, appreciation. So, but I guess part of the appreciation, I guess I'm getting confused sometimes about having that sort of moment or connection which should be very instantaneous. That was not
this is Vipassana, okay? So this is important. Where you will end up in another place. You're just concerned about, I don't want to end up in that different place or that. I can't hear you. It's not like that. When you're doing Vipassana, you are questioning everything. You're investigating everything. Okay? It's sort of like everything will be fine. You will still enjoy life and enjoy that. Don't worry. Okay? But it doesn't mean, when I did that thing with the cookie, it doesn't mean you can't ever eat a cookie. Right? It means the way we go about relating to that which we call a cookie, with attachment and aversions and like and dislike and must have and can't have and sad if we, all that nonsense, the clashes. That's what we want to free ourselves of. So at the end, what? We can enjoy it or not. We can eat it or not. It's not a big deal. Why? It's just a cookie. And what's a cookie? A bundle of crumbs. What's a bundle of crumbs? A bunch of white flour and sugar and water and eggs mixed up together, throwing some heat in. And that's all it is. Is there anything to get bent out of shape of that? It's going to be quick. It really worked. We're at 12:30. Is it a quick? Oh, okay. Okay, then just ring the bell and I'll deal with it, okay? Why don't we just take a moment to... Just a couple of quick things before we end. For the interviews that are not the ones during solitary practice when there isn't formal meditation, but for the interviews when there is formal meditation, we'll all begin together down here. And so when I get up to go upstairs, then everybody can come upstairs. Okay? So you don't have to get there right from the beginning. And then when the interview's over, you just come back down to the meditation hall. Outdoor walking meditation. When we do outdoor walking meditation, again, if you want to do it in, for those of you who've been exposed to traditional kind of practice, if you want to just, pick an area, go back and forth in with eyes down in that formal way, that's fine. In the Thich Nhat Hanh tradition, walking mindfulness meditation is done a little more engaging with nature, eyes open, senses open. But again, You're not out for a walk like exercise. So when you walk in outdoor, you're walking slowly. You're enjoying feeling yourself walking, the steps, the body, the breathing, right? And you're looking. But you're really practicing bare attention. There's no need for any conceptualization, nothing to think about. If thoughts arise or pass away, just let them go. Okay? Except now that we're practicing Vipassana, you may want to do some investigation into what you're experiencing. This afternoon there's solitary practice. I think now you understand. Solitary practice is an opportunity for you to practice outside the structure of the formal meditation. You can go outside and sit somewhere. You can do walking meditation. You can be in here. You can go sit in a chair outside somewhere on the balcony, or, you know, it's your way of practicing by yourself in the way you want. Okay? That's what solitary practice. Deep sharing will be a little different today, but I'll explain that when we meet. And you're clear about, again, how to do a meditation session when you're doing Vipassana. 5 or 10 minutes, stable, very involved, clear, concentrated investigation of some aspect of the five skandhas. When you feel like you've exhausted it, then just, and you've got something from it, right? Some understanding, some insight, some fact that is now clear to you, then just relax and rest the mind for 5 minutes.